Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi folks, Charlie Bazzina here. Join me for my Hunting for Killer show on March 2 at Roomba's Function Centre in Gisborne, just 40 minutes north of Melbourne. I'll be taking you on a unique and fascinating journey, outlining my investigations from discovery of a body to some surprising conclusions. This presentation is not to be missed. Tickets available at trybooking.com, and the ticket price includes a pasta meal and a complimentary glass of wine. Limited seats are available. Hope to see you there.
Thanks for listening and being part of my podcast. I hope 2024 is kind to you. In my 27 years as a Victorian policewoman, I investigated everything from a stolen bicycle to a stolen life. Policing taught me a lot about human nature, which I explore in my podcasts, with a mixture of interesting and thought-provoking guests discussing the human side and impact of crime on all those involved, including the investigators. And I'd love for you to give me a review if you can. They're just a great help to me. I give my guests the opportunity to tell their story in their own words and how they remember an incident. It may not be how others remember it, which I ask you to please keep in mind. My podcasts are not suitable for children and some adults for that matter. If you find yourself affected by my subject matter, contact Lifeline or any other support service or person you feel comfortable with. Thank you.
The concept of private prisons just fundamentally doesn't work because ultimately you've got a system that relies on a steady flow of inmates coming into the prison. The US prison system is definitely a prison system we don't want to try and copy, I can tell you that.
Hope you've had a good week. Today's part two of my interview with Giles, a prison officer with Corrections Victoria for 12 years, six of which were spent in the operations team for Corrections Victoria Intelligence Unit. His role was to investigate prison offences, drug trafficking into prisons, disrupt prison gang activity, investigate staff misconduct, and to provide intelligence information to law enforcement agencies. His inside knowledge of many prisoners that we've all heard about through the media is fascinating, with his role as case manager requiring him to talk and interact with them and support them in many ways. He gives us an insight into their personalities and what it was like dealing with some of Australia's most dangerous criminals. So let's hear part two, shall we? And have a great week. Thank you. Tell us about the differences that you have noted between a private enterprise running a prison and a government body.
Yep.
Can you share with us some thoughts and ideas on that?
Well, so in Victoria, we have the highest ratio of prisoners managed in the private sector. So to give you a bit of insight in how the private prisons work, the state government will determine when they build a new prison whether it's going to be state run or whether it'll be privately run, and they put out a tender, and then that tender is a competitive process between these private organisations. It's typically dominated by three organisations, being GEO, G4S and Serco, and then once they successfully put out the tender, that company will typically have a contract for 25 years. It's based on bed number, I believe. So typically when you look at private prisons, they're significantly larger than than public prisons. So Barwon's got about 400 beds, whereas a place like Ravenhall has 1,600 beds. So you're looking at facilities that are sometimes 3 to 4 times the size of the government ones. So I think when you have that type of environment, the complexities start to become quite exacerbated with that many inmates. And effectively how they run the prison, at a loss to gain more profits. So they get a grant. The only way that the Corrections Victoria can regulate these private bodies is they create a set of service delivery outcomes, we call them SDOs, that surround things like violence, like assault levels, positive drug tests, deaths in custody. If they breach one of those SDOs, we withhold some money. So that's the only incentive they have to be compliant. But any way that they can cut costs means that they can further their profit. So even something trivial like a loaf of bread, if they can get a loaf of bread 50 cents cheaper than another loaf of bread, when you think about 1,600 inmates and you think about the thousands and thousands of loaves that are purchased every week over the course of a year, you're talking about thousands of dollars in savings. So unfortunately what you see is, you know, a lot of instances where they just remove services to inmates because of the incentive to get a greater profit. And I think that the concept of private prisons just fundamentally doesn't work, because ultimately you've got, you know, a system that relies on a steady flow of inmates coming into the prison. If you created a miracle program that transformed prisoners' lives in a heartbeat, they would be without inmates. They wouldn't have that flow coming in and they would be without work. So they rely on recidivism and they rely on, you know, people committing offences. So that's my, you know, pet hate with private prisons, is that they're focused on generating profit, and they're unfortunately a huge flow-on effect because of that mentality.
In fact, they're, from what you're saying, they're encouraging recidivism.
Yeah, I would say, like, there is no, if they, as I said, if they created an environment where recidivism reduced, they've done themselves out of some money. I mean, all of these big companies, G4S, GEO, every time there's a new prison that's built, that's announced it's going to be, you know, a private prison, they're very keen to put up a tender for it. They're keen to expand. And these organisations are run by big American and British organisations. And it's something we've seen in the US as well. You know, unfortunately, we're following suit. And the US prison system is definitely a prison system we don't want to try and copy, I can tell you that.
Mm-hmm. No. Gee, it's good food for thought. You know, it's a shame. It all comes down to money and not the person.
Yeah.
Which, you know, as in the prisoner, they don't care about the prisoner. They want the prisoner to come back because it's all about money.
That's right.
Mm. Yeah. Have you ever worked in a female prison, in a women's prison?
Only for searches. So I haven't done a heck of a lot at the women's, but probably a dozen or so times I've gone in there to do some targeted searches, which has always been, you know, a fascinating time. I've always went away with a smile on my face. The women are very different than the men, and they're very curious about who these people are. Like, so people like myself who might come in for a day or two, they're always very curious, asking you lots of questions, whereas the men, they don't really care. Like, you could walk from one end of the prison to the other without them not acknowledging your existence. But the women, as soon as you walk through the door, they're asking you who you are, what are you doing, and the dynamics are very interesting, and they just They have a very long memory. I remember I remember one time I was there for a meeting of all things, and I was standing in an officer's post, and the officer's post controlled the doors, and this woman stood at the door with her hands on her hips, just giving me this greasy look, and I gestured to her, "I'm not opening the door. It's not my post. I'm not the prison officer here. It's somebody else." Mm-hmm. And anyway, a short time later, the prison officer came back and opened the door, and she's come in and she says, "Who are you?" And I'm like, "Oh, I'm just a staff member coming for a meeting." She's like, "Why have you got such attitude?" And I'm like, "I beg your pardon." I said, "Pardon?" And she's like, "You've got such attitude." And I'm like, I said, "This is not where I work. I can't let you in." So she stormed off, sat on the bench. Then another inmate came in. She says, "Who's that?" And she's like, "Oh, that's a prison officer with attitude." And then about 2 or 3 years later, I remember doing a search in a cell. And it so happened that the search I was doing was the same woman. I didn't recognize her. But she recognized me immediately, and she said, "Oh, you're that prison officer with attitude." And I couldn't believe it. So, the dynamics are very interesting. And working in Intel, one of the things I've noticed, like the men seem to get some type of purpose from joining a gang. They find that brotherhood, which is quite interesting because the women don't tend to form gangs. And I wonder if they don't seem to get along well enough to form gangs. They may have that intent, but there's a lot of politics with the women. Like there, a lot of when a female comes inside, about 60 or 70% will end up in a same-sex relationship, and so they are going out with one another, and then they break up, and it becomes very political. So it's. Yeah. It's a whole minefield. I feel sorry for people that have to deal with female placement because there's so many, you know, ex-girlfriends hanging around that can't mix with one another. I don't know how they manage strategically placing them in the units.
Yeah, like a very toxic environment, I suppose, with all the nuances from, you know, relationship breakups and...
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You know... I'm just thinking with you talking, I was going to ask a question about the differences between a male prison and a female prison, and I thought it sounded a bit naive, you know, obvious, other than the obvious, you know, we're just made different. But it was more about the psychology around women prisoners to men prisoners, and you have just explained it. It's not actually such a naive question because it's just a fascinating insight into human behaviour and the difference between the two type of prisoners.
Well, women tend to be a lot more independent, so I find they tend to arc up a lot more because, you know, that person will have a particular gripe with you, but there's no one really to come in and try and rationalise with that prisoner, whereas in the men's you'll have, you know, this very structured hierarchy within these gangs, and so if one crook starts to arc up, you'll quite often have somebody that they report to within their gang that will pull them back and say, you know, just pull your head in, you're highlighting the group, or you don't need to do that, it's not worth it. There's somebody there rationalising with them, but I've never seen that with the women. They tend to be a lot more isolated, but their need for emotional support, and I think the reason why there's so much same-sex relationships in the prison in the women's is because they need that companion, that they need that person to play almost like a real family, especially in the lower security facility at Tarrengower. You kind of see the dynamic that they don't create a gang, they try and create a family. They've got their sisters, they've got their mum, they've got their, you know, their daughter type situation. The other interesting thing as well is that there's children in female facilities. So I don't know the age in which children can stay with their mother. I think it's maybe three or four years of age. So at one point there was about 20 kids there. So that creates a different dynamic as well. They're in a different area. But it does create a different dynamic when you have people that, especially in that first few years of sometimes having their first child, a lot of the older women will come and help out. But it also changes the dynamic between staff. I remember when I was just doing a tour there, one of the girls was freaking out. She just had her first baby, and this prison officer's effectively telling her how to, you know, breastfeed and telling her how to change nappies and effectively, you know, being that person that she's never had in her life. So the dynamic is a lot different from the men's.
God, amazing. You've had a lot to do with some prisoners which are well known to most of us in the community through the media. I was wondering if you could maybe share with us some insights. Like the other day you were telling us, and just to give you a little bit of a heads up, for instance, you told us a bit about John Sharp, about Peter Dupas, Julian Knight, Tony Mockbell. Like these are names that are just so well known in the media as prisoners. Can you tell us a little bit about your insights into them?
Yeah, so the reason why I brought this up the other day is because I've listened to your podcast for some time now, and I listened to the podcast that you had where you talked about John Sharp, and you were interviewing one of your colleagues that was involved with that particular case. And I found that fascinating to hear, I suppose, what the investigation side of it, because I have had a lot of involvement with John Sharp when he was managed at Barwon. So I would have regular discussions with him. And in fact, at one point I was his case officer. So every prisoner is allocated a prison officer who will look after their, I suppose, their administration stuff. So look out for their visits, any programs they've got to do, the case officer will make sure that they complete those programs, bit of behavioural management as well, trying to get insight into what the prisoner wants so that you can make the appropriate referrals and whatnot. So over the years I got to speak to John Sharp quite a bit, and we're talking before about prisoners who would give you some and prisoners that would not give you much, and John Sharp is just one of these people. We used to call him the walking corpse because he's got the sunken eyes. He's this tall, skinny, pale person.
A weed.
And he just kind of, he does not engage in conversation. I've had more intellectual conversations with a brick wall than I have had with him.
Why doesn't that surprise me?
And I just, it was fascinating to hear, you know, how I was fascinated when you said he took the mobile phone of the victim and was making calls after it, and then he just hid it in a park or something. It just shows you, I think it gives you insight into how much lack of intelligence this guy has, and that's something that I've observed. Like, he is just a drip. And, I just find it – I really find it fascinating because when we often see movies and documentaries, you know, we were talking before about The Silence of the Lambs and, you know, movies that portray serial killers, there is that character that it, you know, they obviously are made to generate a profit. But in real life, serial killers are very boring people because they lack empathy. They're not interested in what you have to say, so they don't engage in conversation. They're very self-absorbed, and they Even just small things I've observed, like their personal hygiene is atrocious. I've had to, a person like Julian Knight, you know, you have to tell him, you know, you need to clean your teeth, you need to put on some deodorant, you need to have a shower, because they just, they don't think about the impact that it's having on people around them. Like prisoners will be complaining about their body odour and you have to have a discussion. And sometimes they take these things on board, but it's interesting that they never think about their own hygiene, because it doesn't affect them. You know, it affects other people.
I mean, I was just gonna say something really silly then, yeah, about they have no self-respect, but of course they don't.
No.
You know, they don't. Well, but then in a way, we're saying they think of themselves only and not others. But they. Oh, I just can't imagine that you wouldn't worry about your breath smelling or you having body odour. Like, to most of us, you would do anything to not offend somebody or to offend yourself, you know?
Yeah, that's right. It's funny. They've got an ego. They've got a self-importance. But, it's weird. They've got an ego, but it's not about their physical appearance or about the way they're perceived by other people. It's just whatever stimulates them. You know, they're focused on themselves only and nobody else. So I've always found that very interesting, because when I first came in, I read every true crime book and listened to every documentary on the face of the planet. And, I was expecting more. I was expecting to have these really intellectual conversations with these people, and to get nothing was just very disappointing. I always thought I could try, and I just had this fascination. I thought one day I might be able to, you know, get an admission from one of these guys about one of the murders that they have committed.
Yeah.
But you try and just have a little conversation, and it's just met with, like, just nothing. It's just very, like, another one I could never talk to was Ashley Coulston. You know, I would try and talk to him at length. Peter Dupas is the same. Just absolutely nothing. And all they would do is just sit on a table and play Scrabble all day, every day. And I just found it fascinating how all these notorious serial killers would just sit and they wouldn't talk. That was the other interesting thing. Sometimes you'd go and sit next to them. There would be no talking. It was just playing a game. And they'd do that day in, day out. I don't know how they found that interesting, but still to this day it perplexes me. But that's what happened. It's a very bizarre world.
Who was on that table? Who would be playing Scrabble and not communicating?
Dupas, Coulston, I've forgotten his name now, the hot chocolate rapist. And then you had Dena would, every now and then when he wasn't in management, Dena, Farkelson, the guy who drove his kids into the dam, and then Freeman, the guy who threw his daughter off the Westgate. There was a few. The other one, he was never in this particular area, but the other one that I used to be quite fascinated talking to, once again you don't get much from him, was Paul Haig. A lot of people forget about him. He was, I think he's probably the most, in terms of the amount of people, victims that he had, I think he's got the most that he's been convicted for. Like, there's others that, of course, have never been solved. But, not much is said about him, but he's a very absent individual. And he's another one that I've tried to talk to over the years. And
there's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
And just get donuts from. It's, you know, I wish I could say more, but you just literally get nothing from them. And you get, when I say you get to know them, like you spend an 8-hour shift with them. And so, you know, when you kind of compare how much time you're spending with your family, I was spending more time with these people than I would be my own family. Some of the inmates, you get to know them really well, you know, what their interests were, you got to know their routine, but these guys, just nothing, absolutely nothing. And the rapport never really came with them. You could ask them to do something, they'd do it for you. There wasn't misbehavior, but in terms of actually trying to get a little bit of insight, you could get very little.
Who tell us about Paul Haig. I must admit, I know most names that you're talking. Well, I know all the names you're talking about there, but I don't. I probably should know. Who is Paul Haig?
Well, Paul Haig, I believe, I don't know all his crimes. I believe he killed about 7 or 8 people in the late 70s and early 80s. And I'd say if you looked at all the inmates that are currently incarcerated, he's probably been the longest serving in Victoria.
Okay.
So I don't know who he, I don't know his, much about the victims he killed, but, I believe it wasn't like he was, you know, killing young girls or anything like that. Like he had a set, an ideal victim. But I believe he killed people who had done wrong by him. So, like, he'd have a – I think he might have killed a used car salesman or something like that. He killed another one in prison. Just people that put him offside, people that know him quite well. I remember speaking to some other prison officers. We talked about that other inmate who had those eyes that he just kind of glaze over and then – change. And Haig is one of those individuals that you've got to be very mindful of what you say about him, because certain things just trigger him and he stews on it and then he will act on his I suppose his intentions.
I suppose you've got to be extremely hyper-vigilant around a lot of prisoners, but particularly someone like him. Hey, what can you tell us about your involvement with Paul Denyer?
Paul Denyer. So mainly had involvement in Paul Denyer when he was in management units. So he's quite interesting because during his term of incarceration, he started to identify as a female, and he actually applied to the state government to get like surgery, but that was denied. And then I believe.
Do you think a prisoner should be able to have, let's say, reconstructive surgery? That's a deep question.
Yeah, it's
the first thing I thought of.
It's a challenging question because at the end of the day, like, you're getting. I think you've got to look at the situation, and there was a long period of time where he was incarcerated where he didn't identify as a female and he showed no intention of becoming a female, and then all of a sudden he decided he would become a female. And I believe, having spoken to some prison officers in recent months, that he's now back to identifying as a man. So I don't know whether his intent to transition was genuine. I think it may have been more of a strategy to get some things that he wanted or to be dealt with in a certain way. I think, especially with Denyer, I think he quite likes his profile, and I think him transitioning and getting some headlines, it stimulated him, and it's a way of getting attention, I think, and he likes that attention. So that's my personal opinion on it. And I mean, you raise a very interesting question about people that are transgender coming into the system. I mean, that in itself you could have a podcast about, because it's very difficult to make that assessment. You've got instances where you have people that are men that identify as female that have offended against young females, and they're requesting to go to the DPFC facility. And they haven't got their surgery, so they still, you know, got functioning genitalia. So we have had instances where men incarcerated in the female facility there was one instance where the women actually petitioned to get that person removed because of their criminal history offending against young women. So it has happened where you get transgender people that come in, and even though they've got functioning body parts, they'll go to the women's. Typically, when it's the other way around, I don't think I've ever had an instance where you have women that have transitioned to men and they prefer to be incarcerated in the male system. They typically elect to get incarcerated at the Dame Phyllis Centre just because they're a little bit vulnerable. But it does create a complexity. But you do have to ask the question, are they transitioning for a genuine reason when they're in prison, especially when there's been no prior inclination of it for 10, 15 years, like some of the instances we've seen in Corrections Victoria. So I think definitely for Denyer, it was an attention-seeking thing. Mm.
But then, and you're right, we could have a whole podcast about this, because then you've got somebody, I hate to put Danny Laidley in the same conversation as Paul Denyer, but Danny Laidley, she kept her, but she kept that secret for years, you know. So to try and determine who is genuine and who isn't, and like, that is a complexity in a prison. You're right, I hadn't thought of that, about putting a female that is identifying, a man identifying as a female, and putting him or her, they, in a prison with other women. I can't imagine trying to manage that, how you would manage it.
Yeah, it's very difficult, and it's a bit of a moral dilemma that we've got.
Very much so. Good.
So, and especially when you have especially predatory sex offenders that see an opportunity maybe to, you know, if I say I transition and I can get transferred to a female prison, are you facilitating and aiding that by doing so? So it's one of those things. I don't think there's a right or wrong way. I think it's about getting to know inmates, and that's where you can rely on intelligence and the information we've collected on people for a long period of time to make those hard decisions, because we see a pattern of behaviour, or we've got some documented, information that may indicate either way.
Do you think that, and this is a question I've just thought of, do you think that there will come a time when we have a prison for LGBTQIA+? Like, do you think it's going to get to that point?
Look, I think it's difficult to do that, because I think ultimately, I think when you look at corrections, I think they don't want to highlight people and categorise people in that way and just effectively create a facility for that. You know, generally speaking, one of the things that surprised me about working in a prison is that inmates are quite open to people who are gay or bisexual, or there's in terms of staff, I'd say there's quite a few staff member that openly gay that work in the prison environment, and they don't seem to have any problems with the inmates. And there are openly gay inmates in the system that don't seem to have any problems. So I think, you know, we've come a long way, and I don't think there's really a need to start separating people because of the way that they identify or their sexuality or anything. But I think when it comes to transgender people, I think the main thing you need to get insight into is their agenda and their reasoning behind it, and why now, you know, rather than before or whatever that may be. And look, generally speaking, what I found is that quite a few people that transition, that's like some that transition to female that stay in adult male facilities, they're quite okay with that. In fact, they choose to stay in those facilities because that's where they feel comfortable. It might be more of a familiar environment to them, especially if they've come into the system a few times. You know, they probably would be put into protection. I think one of the things that has surprised me is how prisoners are pretty open to diversity.
Maybe how accepting they are, as opposed to in the outside world.
I think a few of these guys are outcasts. Like they've been rejected by their family, or they've had the hard upbringing. So I think they know what it feels like to be persecuted a bit. We've got a lot of minority groups that are heavily represented in prison. So we've got a very large Vietnamese population in prison, very large African population in prison. So, you know, a lot of these minority groups have experienced, untoward behaviour in the community. So there's a lot more acceptance in prison, I think. Typically, when we talk about gangs again, I think typically people tend to associate with people of their own race. So when I say they're accepting, I think they find that friendship and that their alliances with people of their own ethnicity. But, I think it's a lot more accepting than I thought when I first came in.
I hate to bring this to a close, but I think we have a lot more information to have another interview with you. You've just got such a fascinating insight. But can we just touch on, before we do bring today to a close, can we just touch on your experiences with Tony Mockbell and Peter Dupas? And I just thought, you told me a story the other day about Peter Dupas and a story about some secateurs. I was wondering if you might share that with us.
I used to read a lot and watch a lot of documentaries, and I read Andrew Fraser's book. I think it was called Something Soup, and he was one of the prisoners that was housed with Dupas at Port Phillip, and he got an admission from him in relation to, I think it was for the Hal Vargas murder.
Yes, and, I believe so.
And he was quite instrumental in being a witness for that, and Dupas was subsequently found guilty of that offence. And I read that he said he always thought, you know, Dupas was a bit weird because he was a garden billet and he'd collect these mouses and he'd use the secateurs and he'd chop them up and he'd get a thrill from seeing these mice struggle and then die. And, he would do this quite regularly. And so when I first started in the unit, the first thing someone comes up, it was Peter Dupas. And initially I was like, this is the first time I've ever met him. I'm like, oh, this is Dupas. And all of a sudden he says, oh, can I have some secateurs? And I nearly fell over. I looked at the staff and I'm like, do you know what he does with the secateurs? And they're like, well, no. Like, what does he do with the secateurs? And I'm like, he chops up like mouses and things in the yard and stuff like that. And they're like, well, where did you read that? I'm like, oh, in this book. So I said, do I give it to him? And then they're like, yeah, just give him the secateurs. He's the garden billet. So off he goes. And you see him out in the yard. I never saw him chopping out mouses, but I'd spoken to other inmates who confirmed, like, if he sees a small animal, he would just torture it, chop its tail off or chop it up, and he just, gets a thrill by seeing something squirm and die. So that I found that it was a bit of a shock when he asked me for secateurs the first time. So, but then I got used to it.
What do you mean the first time? Did he ask for them a lot, did he?
Oh, yeah, because he was the garden billet. He would get them most days. So doing some pruning around the place and pest control, apparently.
Really?
So, yeah, he...
I can hardly... And I apologise to the listeners. It's a bit graphic, but just... The fact that he's just given them and, like, to put him in gardening where, as you say, there's pests, a lot of pest control and that. I mean, you know, he'd think, oh, I'm sorry, but he'd think that was Christmas. And just tell us about, lastly, your dealings with Tony Mockbell or your knowledge of him.
I've dealt with him a lot, like, in various different areas. Like, I think one of the things is that, because he's such a personality, you know, he's, you know, a lot of people look up to him, and I suppose he's got quite an established network within the criminal world. So I've always found it interesting talking to him because I've taken an interest in some of the underworld goings on over the years. And you know, you could ask him really any question and he'd tell you, you know, who was who and what was happening.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, so he was quite open about...
Yeah, very, very open. And okay. I never forget, like, one night in Banksia, like, he'd been separated from the main compound and, as I said, they talk in the underneath their cells at night, and I was positioned, I was on the stairs and I... was positioned where they couldn't see me. And, you know, a lot of the inmates, the younger inmates, were asking him about various you know, people in the underworld and what their involvement was, and he would just tell them everything. And I sat there for a couple of hours listening to all of his stories. And I think he gets off on the fact that he's got a bit of profile, and you know, a lot of his exploits have been documented in various books and movies and whatnot. Mm. And I think, unfortunately, over the years, because of his profile, management are always a bit cautious dealing with him because they don't want negative publicity. Because if you know, he's got the contacts to, you know, get out there and say, oh, this has happened. And I think ultimately when it comes to government, it's about preserving your image. And so I think because of that, he's got a little bit of control when it comes to dealing with staff. And typically he's got a bit of control over some of the younger guys as well. But, you know, it's also cost him as well. He was quite badly assaulted a few years ago because I think he's, he got a bit too big for his boots. And so I think a few other younger lads wanted to set the story straight, and he was attacked. So, you know, it's one of those things, you kind of, if you're playing by the, you know, live by the sword, you die by the sword type thing. So, he's an interesting character. And, you know, he's surprisingly easy to get on with. You know, you can have a good joke with him and have a discussion with him like you or I will have a discussion. And you kind of realise how much control some of these underworld figures had. You're talking hundreds of millions of dollars of incomes from drugs and other, you know, gambling exploits that they had, and how much control they had over things like professional sport. I'm a big fan of boxing, and, you know, he was telling us about, you know, the Lester Ellis and Barry Michael fight, and, you know, how Alfonso Gangitano was behind Lester Ellis, and there was a lot of funding that fight was funded by Gangitano. And I find that fascinating because it's part of history. And, you know, here he's telling how the underworld had influence on that. So,
yeah, it's frightening stuff, really frightening. And, you know, he is where he deserves to be. Look, Giles, I've got to say thank you, and thank your family, please, yet again, for hounding and nagging you to contact me. It's just a fascinating insight that the public rarely get. I believe you applied for Victoria Police and prisons at the same time, and I think that Victoria Police missed out big time in you being offered a job at prisons prior to policing. But prisons need people like you. It's obvious that you care, and it doesn't go unnoticed that you have often referred to prisoners as clients, which just shows the respect that you have for humanity. Even though you have seen it at its worst, you possess so many qualities that a good investigator needs. You know, you're respectful, you do genuinely care, you listen, you empathise to a point, and you're able to put aside the terrible atrocities that someone has done to another to treat them fairly. Not a lot of people can do that. I wish you luck in the future, and thanks for sharing your experiences with us. I know that we will all leave today, me included, so much more educated and maybe a little more understanding of why we've got the problems we've got in prisons. So thank you for your time, and as I say, please thank your family.
I will do. Thanks for the kind words, and it's been great.
It has, Giles. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
See you later.
See ya.
As you've probably noticed, we've moved to a new platform called Acast. I think that's the right expression, I've got no idea. And my previous reviews haven't transferred over. I need reviews. Could you do me a favour and put up a review? And thank you so much for your support and patronage. With your help, I can give you that little bit extra. Thanks.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.